From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, this is Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I hope you're feeling hungry because today we're talking food. From the politics of production.
We come, drop off the food, and we go. No one knows what we look like. Yeah, we're just the happy Mexicans delivering tacos. Look, by the way, they're going to have a Cinco de Mayo celebration.
To the pleasures of consumption.
Whenever I leave Austin and go somewhere else, I'm always like, let's go get breakfast tacos. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I just am devastated.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, we start with a food fight. Dominican-born Bronx resident Majida Newbold is preparing for the inevitable, a looming cut to the food stamp program.
It's forcing me to do other things like fasting and practicing how to fast so I could control my hunger.
Yes, that is an American talking about hunger in the year 2013. And because there's been so much hunger in our country, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, was expanded in the year 2009 as part of the stimulus package at the height of the recession. Food stamp enrollment doubled since then, from 26 million in 2007 to nearly 48 million now. But what most Americans don't know is that on November 1st, this expansion to help feed America is set to expire. Millions will have their benefits reduced. And a double whammy. Despite this schedule rollback, Congress is considering additional cuts. Here's Congressman Steve King, Republican of Iowa, talking about SNAP on the House floor.
You might have thought that America had a safety net. No, sir, it's a hammock. It's a hammock with 80 different means-tested welfare programs in it, and they're out of hand. And this administration is promoting the expansion of them for political purposes.
Last month, the House passed a bill cutting almost $40 billion from SNAP as part of the reauthorization of the Farm Bill, the law that pays for food stamps. Conservatives say cuts are needed to trim the budget, but advocates say they will push poor Americans, especially Blacks and Latinos, off the hunger cliff. Latino USA producer Diana Montaño talked to a few New Yorkers about what these cuts will mean for them.
A line of mainly Black and Latino residents winds out the door at the community kitchen and food pantry of West Harlem. 56-year-old Miguel Rodriguez waits outside with his wife to collect food. He lost his factory job after 9/11 and ever since has had a hard time getting back on his feet. Miguel says food stamps help him get by and that without them, he might not be able to pay the rent. If they were cut, he would have to depend more on pantries like this one to get food and help his family.
Latinos have the highest rates of food insecurity of any group in the country, which is shocking for some people to learn.
That's Triada Stampus. She's Senior Director of Government Relations at Food Bank of New York City, the organization that runs the West Harlem pantry where Miguel goes. She recently spoke at a Harlem press conference denouncing the rollbacks.
These cuts are bigger than the amount of food that we distribute over the course of a year, and we are the biggest food bank in the country.
Triada says even the country's biggest food bank isn't ready for the November cuts.
This is not a cut that a food pantry or a soup kitchen is going to be able to absorb. There is a meal gap in our city of 100 million meals a year, despite the collective efforts of this emergency food network. And taking away 76 million meals more is beyond imagination at this point, and yet it's going to be in 1 month our reality. And what beggars belief even more than that is that we are in an environment where our national representatives in Congress are not talking about how do we undo this, how do we save the food resources that low-income Americans rely on. Instead, they're talking about how can we cut more from the program, and that is really outrageous.
In 2010, President Obama vowed to find funds before the food stamp cuts began this year, but this never happened. And Republicans are adamant about reforming SNAP through the pending Farm Bill reauthorization.
We need to also just look at this program in the context of the wider welfare system.
Rachel Sheffield is a fellow at a conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. She has been writing about SNAP for their blog.
We should reform welfare so that we are requiring something of the individual receiving aid, if they're able-bodied, to require them to either work or to prepare for work. The idea should be to promote self-sufficiency.
New York State Senator Gustavo Rivera represents a district in the Bronx which is 60% Latino. He says it doesn't make sense to enforce strict work requirements with the job market still suffering.
They don't need government assistance because they're lazy. They need government assistance because they find themselves with jobs that don't pay enough to say to them, to say to a hungry person, and more importantly, to a person that has a hungry child, you don't get to eat now because we don't think that you worked hard enough. So we're going to penalize you so you're not going to be able to eat now and your child is going to go to bed hungry. I do not believe that that is the way that we should run a society.
A quarter of food stamp recipients are elderly or disabled. Even though they can't work, the coming cuts will impact them too. Jackie Williams is an African-American Harlem resident who went on food stamps after being diagnosed with breast cancer.
Being a person diagnosed with breast cancer, I have to even eat differently. I can't have boxes and cans and things of that nature because it feeds the cancer. And what the economy is now, I have to choose between going to work or getting chemo. And it's like I'm totally stressed. Not only am I stressed about this whole cancer thing, I'm stressed about 30 days. You're going to cut money and I can't eat. It's like a kick in the belly almost. It's like I need you now. And now you're cutting.
Congress right now is acting like an illusionist.
Joel Berg is the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger.
Illusionists use the process they call misdirection. With one hand, they hold up the shiny object they want you to see, and with the other hand, they're hiding the rabbit that they don't want you to see. They are using misdirection now, bringing up the fiscal cliff, bringing up the government shutdown, bringing up Obamacare, all to distract American people away from the fact that all Americans, and disproportionately Latino Americans, are having their food benefits cut, their housing benefits cut, their basic survival benefits cut.
So while Congress debates the budget for programs like SNAP, and while Recovery Act protections for poor Americans expire, Majida Newbold will continue to think about what's on her plate.
It's going to be a sad story, you know, to see people go without. I'm going to have to just extend myself, you know, eat crackers, soy milk. What else can I afford?
For Latino USA, I'm Diana Montaño.
So let us know how these nutrition program cuts are affecting your community. Let us know by Facebook or on Twitter. You can call us at our listener line at 646-571-1228. Tell us your story. And now, a little breakfast. How about some desayuno? Well, every day in Austin, Texas, thousands of people start their mornings with breakfast tacos. They became popular in the 1980s when the city's food scene started to take off. Austin transplant Mando Reyes loves tacos so much, he decided to write a book about them called Austin Breakfast Tacos. He let reporter Haley Howell tag along with him to give her a taste of his favorite places.
Mando Rayo and I are having our first coffee of the day. He tells me it all started when he was 5 years old, and his uncle sat him down with a bowl of beans and a whole jalapeno.
And he's like, you are not getting up until you finish that plate and that jalapeno. And that was like my test of Mexicanhood.
So began Mando Rayo's lifelong romance with spicy Tex-Mex cuisine. As an adult, he researched the roots of breakfast tacos, going back to the meat markets and tortilla factories of the 19th century. The gems of his research are compiled in his very own book, Austin Breakfast Tacos.
So it's a mix of all that put together in one book, over 40 recipes. It's the culture, the people of Austin, and all of it coming together for the love of the breakfast taco.
Every taqueria in town knows who Mondo is. Tacos are his passion, and he goes to lengths other people would probably shy away from.
You are not a man if you do not take salsa shots.
And that's just literally taking a shot of salsa.
Yes, it's the best.
Watching a guy chug green salsa out of a small paper takeout cup might turn heads in other cities. But at Taco Deli in Austin, this is just another Thursday morning.
Howdy. What's up, Mondo?
How you doing?
Doing good. What's up?
By the time we get to the front of the line at Taco Deli, three people have suggested a taco called the Otto. It's not your lowest calorie option.
All right, so the Otto is refried black beans and cheese, Monterey Jack with bacon and avocado.
That's Roberto Espinosa. He opened the first Taco Deli in 1999. There are three in town now.
That's actually one of our best-selling breakfast tacos.
10, 11, 12. There's about 15 people back here in this kitchen. There are about 7 people cooking or doing the assembly lines. Ooh, I see some carne asada going by.
Too hot for us. So Mondo and I head across Town Lake to Papalote on South Lamar Boulevard.
One of my favorite tacos here is what I call the poor man's taco, which is weenies and huevos.
Even though it's 95 degrees outside, people are sitting on the patio with tacos and hot coffee.
I'm Nate Wells. I'm having a potato egg and cheese and a bacon egg and cheese on flour. I come here every weekday morning.
So you don't get sick of breakfast tacos for breakfast every morning?
I don't know how, but no. And whenever I leave Austin and go somewhere else, I'm always like, let's go get breakfast tacos. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I just am devastated. I don't know what else to do.
Our last stop isn't a restaurant. It's a tiny little food truck called Pueblo Viejo in a newly trendy neighborhood in East Austin. It caters to people who like to eat their tacos in the wee hours.
Or maybe you're out and you're like, hey, I gotta have my breakfast taco, you know, after, you know, we go out and party, it's 2 a.m.
For us, it's 11 a.m. Mondo and I are sitting at a picnic table having tacos with
eggs and cheese. You could see the cheese just melted on the tortilla. Spinach and mushrooms. It's food for the soul in a folded corn or flour tortilla. That's what it is.
A simple Yelp search finds more than 1,000 restaurants claiming to serve breakfast tacos in Austin. As I wash down a particularly spicy bite of huevos con weenies with a big glass of horchata, I wonder how on earth you'd go about choosing the best tacos to eat in Austin. Luckily, there's a book for that. For Latino USA, I'm Haley Howell in Austin, Texas.
Austin Breakfast Tacos is the book written by Mando Reyes and Jared Neese. To find out more, check out our website at latinousa.org. Coming up in our Futuro Media newsroom, we don't just love tacos. We also have a deep, abiding love for the humble plátano.
Oh, plátano, how do I love thee? Let me tell you the ways.
Stay with us on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Llevarla a tu casa, bajar el caldero, agasajar a unos viajeros. Extraña calabaza, el amor, 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 amor.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Chef, TV host, and writer Anthony Bourdain once told a reporter, "The food that I love most is made by poor people for poor people." And if you open your eyes, you know there's an undeniable presence of undocumented Latino immigrants in our country's kitchens.
Es carne de res para los tacos.
Underpaid, overworked, but dreaming of a better life for their children and for themselves.
María, mucho gusto en conocerla, finalmente.
Hola, Carolina.
One of those people, the invisible Latina who makes the food you consume, is Carolina Santos. I met her recently in West Oakland, California. Carolina and her mother, Rosa Oliva, came here from Mexico.
We used to travel back and forth from Oaxaca to the city, and then when I finally started first grade, then we moved to the city permanently.
To Mexico City.
So I was there from like 6 to 11, and then we moved, transition once again, to the States. A lot of transitions. Not fun at times.
But you're laughing about it.
Well, what can you do?
Carolina tells me she laughs because she can't cry about it, even though her life is a contradiction, because what she really wishes she could be doing is going to college and studying philosophy and then having a career. But for now, she's working in the kitchen. It's a cramped space on a forgotten, barren corner of West Oakland. Maybe not what you'd expect for a kitchen that churns out hundreds of tamales and tacos every week. A huge pot of mole simmers near an equally huge container of black beans. In this tight space, her mom, Rosa Oliva, prepares pounds of rice for delivery to corporate clients later in the day.
Los frijoles, bueno, el arroz ya, ¿verdad?
No. Ya tengo los frijoles ahí, pero voy a hacer la carne y voy a hacer el arroz.
To produce food on a massive scale, Carolina and Rosa Oliva get up super early, and they stock up on supplies daily. On this day, Carolina took me with her to the market before the cooking began in earnest.
We are at the produce market.
She buys her supplies wholesale from two different vendors at a market that's not open to the public.
Buenos días.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Muy bien.
Hace mucho que no lo veía.
Sí, hombre.
Okay.
¿Qué le vamos a ayudar?
Órale, pues mire, necesito híjole. Necesito mixed green salad para 100 personas, pero no sé cuántas cajas. Deme unas cuatro.
As a retail vendor, Carolina can get fresh veggies here. Cilantro, greens, jalapeños, avocados.
Cabbage solita, ¿no?
Sí.
But in her neighborhood where she lives, the grocery stores are a different story. She tells me while we're in the car.
I mean, they offer like a little bit of everything. It's not strictly liquor. I feel like the maybe little bit of vegetables that they offer is kind of like a side job, you know? I feel like the main revenue for them, like the main profit, comes from selling liquor and beer and whatever, or sodas or fast food, you know?
Carolina and her family live in what you might call a food swamp. Not a food desert where there are no grocery stores, but an area where the food that is available to low-income people is, well, not good.
So we're driving now along the streets of your community. I see one small market. That's the first corner market I've seen in all of the driving that we've done this morning.
Actually, I didn't point them out, but there's about three of them in about five blocks.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing, or no?
Well, from my standards or from my mother's standards, we could not possibly do grocery shopping in those places. They have cans or can, you know.
So it says corner market, but in your mind, what you're seeing is liquor store and canned foods.
Pretty much. Yeah.
But Oakland is gentrifying and developing.
There's like vegan soul food,
yes.
Japanese restaurant, giant, what is this, burger over here.
Yeah.
So this is the gentrified area, though. Am I right?
Well, Jack London Square is kind of like a little, like commercial center. So, you know, there's always been a lot of businesses and things like that here. But at the same time, they just, like, built that place called the Ellington, where you find, like, $1 million, like, apartment. This whole gentrification game, to me, sometimes boggles my mind, because you can have a place like here where you have the produce market where people like us come to shop, but then you have like a building where you can buy $1 million loft.
That's not to say working folks don't take advantage when high-end businesses do move in. Even though it drives Carolina's mother crazy, on some days after shopping in her dirty work clothes, Carolina swings by her favorite, gentrified coffee shop.
From here, I go to grab cafecito, un latte, a blue bottle coffee. They're the best. Talk about food snobs. These people are some real food snobs.
But you like your coffee from there.
I do. I'm such a hypocrite because I always talk shit about them.
But that's just the thing. If it's good.
But it's not accessible to many people of our skin color. The latte is $4 a cup.
In a way, Carolina's love for this gourmet coffee speaks to her desire for success, her urge to make it. And who could blame her? I mean, the coffee was delicious.
Wow. It's a real... It's definitely a gift to yourself to drink that coffee.
Back at the cramped kitchen, her mother, Rosa Oliva, a tough woman who migrated with two children and who can pick up a pot of boiling water without potholders, told me tearfully about her dreams for her daughter.
What do you think about your daughter's independence? The fact that what she really would like to be doing is studying in a university and studying philosophy.
Yeah. Sí, es, a mí sí me gustaría que fuera ella a estudiar porque es un sueño de ella.
Yes, I'd like that she goes to study. It's her dream. It gives me pause because we haven't been able to make it happen. When you're undocumented in this country, it's not easy to achieve those dreams. It's hard. She can't go study because we don't have the money. But like they say, it's never too late.
The moment of emotion happens fast, like everything that takes place in this kitchen. And now, the rush is to get these freshly made tacos packed and delivered to their client. A middleman has arranged for a lunchtime catering job across the bridge in the skyscrapers of San Francisco.
We're on the Bay Bridge now. We cross this bridge almost every day to go deliver our food. At the same time, you know, when I'm traveling, like when I cross this bridge, it's like it's also kind of like another divide of these two worlds that we live in, you know, especially when you go to the financial district. It's like I go and you have this pristine like office spaces and I don't know, people just seem so like fulfilled, you know, with their jobs, and it's two different worlds.
As we pull into downtown, I ask where we're going. Which company was it that ordered a delivery of Carolina's fresh tacos?
It's the company called Lichen. It's right here.
LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Do you know what LinkedIn is?
I do know. They kind of do like social networking or something like that online. I'm telling you, I live in like two worlds, you know, a world in the kitchen where you don't need any of that stuff. You know what I mean? You're just making food, whatever. And then a world where people are like, okay, you need these tools and you need these credentials and you need all of these things.
Up on the 16th floor in the glassy LinkedIn offices, I spoke to Tammy Rant, who works there.
These tacos were made just this morning, all handmade in a community of West Oakland that looks nothing like where we are right now.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah, I didn't know that, but that's incredible, and we really appreciate that. I don't know much of the background on what's going on and why you guys are bringing it in, but it is so nice of you to do that, and I'm very excited.
We weren't greeted when we arrived at LinkedIn's offices. I mean, we were just delivering food, so we were, again, invisible. Tammy seemed a little bewildered at all that we'd be asking about the catering. It was just one more meal ordered by the bosses and brought in by some delivery person. But to Carolina, this was disappointing, even if unsurprising.
Yeah, these people are right around my age. They probably went to college, have these superb jobs where they're making however much money. And yeah, we're just delivering the food. We come, drop off the food, and we go. No one knows what we look like. Yeah, we're just the happy Mexicans delivering tacos.
Look, by the way, they're going to have a Cinco de Mayo celebration.
Meeting Carolina changed the way I look at food. I mean, here she is, a philosopher stuck in a kitchen. Still, Carolina does cook with love, and if you'd like to witness that, we'll be with her at Trinity Lutheran Church in Long Beach, California on October 12th. Go to our website at Latino USA to find out how you can join us there, and you'll be able to get Rosa's recipe for her homemade mole.
Bailan, 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 mujeres de luna. Bailan, 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 que la vida es una.
I was introduced to Rosa Olivas and Carolina Santos through a man named Saqib Kaval. He's a food activist who organizes and cooks at a monthly event in Oakland called The People's Kitchen. It's a community meal, but what Kaval really hopes to do is to feed diners' desire for social justice around food issues. Lisa Moorhouse paid a visit to The People's Kitchen and filed this story.
It's about 5 o'clock on a Saturday, and volunteers are chopping vegetables and arranging tables at a downtown Oakland restaurant.
The first course will be wakame, the seaweed salad.
Saqib Kaval shares the night's menu with volunteer servers.
Miso, maple, glazed tofu, and barbecue sweet potatoes.
One nervous server asks, diners have a menu, right?
Yeah, they have a menu. They have a menu.
The People's Kitchen is a pay-what-you-can handmade meal that pops up for one night a month in an Oakland restaurant. The event is totally dependent on volunteers and a generous restaurant owner.
Saqib, she needs to find a small pot for water. Okay. Can you help her?
Chef Dominica Rice Cisneros trained in New York and Mexico City restaurants and worked in Berkeley at the famed Chez Panisse. This is the sixth time she's handed off her restaurant, Cosecha, to People's Kitchen.
They do a lot of education for the people in their neighborhoods who they feel are don't have a lot of access to organic produce.
She serves Mexican food based on fresh produce, like the food she grew up eating. The values of People's Kitchen match her own.
And I kind of feel like we're trying to do the same thing at Cosecha, is like have a quick lunch in downtown, but having organic produce and meat and dairy, but at a really good price point for everybody.
Each People's Kitchen event is actually a fundraiser for a local nonprofit, and the menu's inspired by their work. Tonight, the featured nonprofit is Fat Beats Produce, which connects small-scale farmers of color to urban neighborhoods through farmers markets and other ventures.
My name is Richard Fermi, Jr. I'm a farmer in French Camp, California, which is 10 miles south of Stockton, California.
Fermi grew up in a farming family. His mother came from Mexico, and his father farmed in the Philippines, then came to California in the 20s and picked asparagus in the Central Valley. Now, Richard Fermi grows the foods he grew up on, all sorts of greens, squash, melons, beans, on his 50-acre farm.
And one of my favorite things to do is grow a lot of old-school vegetables, like black-eyed peas, crowders, purple hulls, okra, and it's like, there's not too many guys that do that anymore. I've got a following for all that. This year I have to plant more.
Who was kind of clamoring for these old school vegetables?
Actually, people who grew up with it. I'll either get the Latino, the black, Filipino. They're like, oh, we used to grow this in our own country, you know.
A young, stylish, diverse crowd settles into communal tables. Printed placemats show some of Oakland's food resources and history. One of them, the Black Panthers Free Breakfast Program, which started here in 1969. Educating diners about food access and activism is the vision of the People's Kitchen, laid out tonight by founder Saqib Kaval.
And what we're trying to do each month is tell food stories and look at how our recipes tell the stories of who we are, tell the stories of our community's resistance, our resiliency, our struggle, our migration, our displacement, enslavement, all of that is in your food, is on your plate. And I really appreciate y'all coming out today and supporting Fat Beats Produce and continuing to support People's Kitchen.
People's Kitchen volunteers will meet to consider ways to turn this event into a full-time collective operation. For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Oakland, California.
So far today, we've focused on several foods that are Mexicano in origin, but we didn't want our Caribbean peoples to feel left out. One of the food staples is plátanos, or plantains. And our producer, Daisy Rosario, is especially, okay, wait for it, bananas for plátanos. Because a plátano is a banana, but it's not a banana.
I like to think of it as the Latino potato.
The Latino potato for plátano?
You know, I have this friend, Billy. One summer, I lived with him in Spanish Harlem. And I come home, and he's got this kind of sour look on his face. I'm like, what's wrong? And he's like, well, I went grocery shopping. You know, I've been wanting to try plantains, so I bought some, and I tried to eat it. And it was really hard to peel.
Most people would look at a plátano, and they think, well, I'm just going to peel it and eat it like a banana.
Exactly.
And you don't do that with plátanos.
He didn't know. And so I had to put it in a context he could understand. It is the Latino potato.
I get it. So you mm-hmm. can't eat it raw.
Exactly.
You love plátanos? What's your favorite way?
Well, I mean, I love mofongo.
All right, but you got to explain what mofongo is. There are a lot of people who are like, okay, what did she just say?
I know. It almost sounds dirty if you don't know what it is. Mofongo. It is kind of smashed up plantain full of wonderful meat or seafood or anything really.
That you're mashing all together and lots of garlic usually.
Absolutely. Lots of garlic.
What other ways do you like plátanos?
Well, when I was young, I loved tostones. Instead of just french fries, I wanted tostones.
The potato thing is really working mm-hmm. because tostones are basically like french fries made out of plátanos.
You cut them up and then you fry them. Then you smash them down so that they're a little flatter. And then you put them back in the fryer, which like the best french fries, twice fried.
My husband is a little bit more partial to maduros, which is a whole other thing.
If you're not as familiar with plantains, you go to a grocery store, you might see the big pile of green and the big pile of yellow. And the green is what you want to make tostones out of. But the yellow, and particularly even almost getting black, to the point where you're maybe afraid of them, is what you want to make the maduros out of. And that's when it's sweet.
So the way I love to eat plátanos, actually, is I love to put olive oil and a little bit of salt. And if I'm really bad, and I know some people would be like really grossed out, I'll put a little bit of mayonnaise.
Ooh.
I know.
I think you're really giving me something to try because I also like french fries with mayonnaise now. So if we're going to stay on the metaphor.
Hey, there you go. French fries. It's the same idea. Okay. So you, Daisy, did some poetry for plátanos.
I think it's probably fair to say that I tried to write a poem about.
We believe in you, Daisy.
I got a little overwhelmed is the thing. I think you'll hear what I mean. Oh, plátano, how do I love thee? Let me tell you the ways. I love you as tostones. I love you as maduros. I love you as mofongo con pinil. I love you as mofongo con camarones. I love you as mofongo con chicharrones. And then the thing is, it can kind of just go on forever as a list of things I like with mofongo.
You are so dramatic. Oh, plátanos, I love you with olive oil and salt.
It's a hard poem to finish. I can work on it for the rest of my life.
You know what? Let's ask our listeners to get involved. So if you have a favorite way to eat plátanos, tell us about it. Check out our plantain recipes that made our mouths water on our website at latinousa.org. Daisy, we love you for sharing plátanos with us.
Thanks, Maria.
Coming up, Latino problems. We've all got them, so we've gone out and found someone to help us navigate them.
My Latino problem is that when I upload a picture of myself, let's say a selfie or something, my parents, they write obituary-like comments.
Our new advice columnist, Pauline Campos, deals with your hashtag Latino problems. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm joined in our studio by producer AC Valdez to talk about that most essential of Mexican foods, the tortilla. AC, the tortilla.
Maria, I have never in my life seen my father eat a flour tortilla.
Oh, so you're like a corn tortilla
Not
family.
Not once. Well, we're a corn tortilla family by default. Now, I love me some flour tortillas, but the thing is, the ubiquitous brand, which I'm not going to name, but everybody out there who has ever eaten a flour tortilla knows which one it is. Those aren't flour tortillas.
I mean, this is the thing, AC. You know, it was so bad when I moved to New York in 1979 that there were no tortillas here. And so I started importing my tortillas. So every time I would go home to Chicago, I'd bring a box.
Which is actually, it's why it made me so excited to hear that we had the piece that we're going to hear next come up. Because a corn tortilla is also just not a corn tortilla.
You know, there's a sound.
Exactly.
You know, and this exactly. is a sound. Something
That's fresh
like,
tortillas.
Like what,
that means
what
fresh
it
tortillas.
Is fresh tortillas. And it's the hands going back and forth, you know, making the tortilla, the dough, to become flat and perfectly round. And then, boom, goes on the griddle. Well, listen, as it turns out, a couple of professors from the Bay Area are actually championing the traditional corn tortilla that your family loves so much as a model of health. They say that traditional Mexican foods can actually help fight sickness and that it's all due to an ancient culinary secret, which they told reporter Tina Rubio all about.
It may sound like we're on a farm, but we're actually inside the colorful Oakland cocina of Luz Calvo and Catriona Rueda Esquivel. All that hen clucking is coming from their wild garden outside. Today's menu? Fresh corn tortillas. Luz uses only three ingredients.
Corn, lime, and salt.
The lime is not the kind of lime that grows on trees. It's an odorless white powder that's mixed with water to create a thickener. The corn has been soaking in it all night. It's one of the key ancestral ingredients that makes these tortillas healthier.
Indigenous people have been growing corn for 7,000 or 9,000 years in the Americas, but around 1500 BC, they developed this process of nixtamalization.
That's Luz's partner, Catriona.
And it's treating the corn with lime from ash that loosens the skin, and you take the skin off, and it releases all these nutrients in the corn.
I'm just going to take the corn between my hands and rub.
That's so the hulls come off.
Just having your hands in the corn and the water, it feels like magic.
And a healthy dose of magic was exactly what Luz felt she needed.
So in 2006, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was 45 years old. And it really had a profound impact on my kind of spirit. I think I had susto, which is when you become disconnected from your spirit, and I was really scared.
But that fear was her inspiration for rediscovering her traditional culinary roots, from the organic Mexican herbs and fruits she grows to her tortillas. We're ready to grind the corn.
So you can see the ground corn starting to come out through the grinder. This is grinding really nicely. It's coming out nice and soft and fluffy.
She adds a pinch of salt and kneads the dough into a big ball. Then she breaks off pieces and shapes them into smaller walnut-sized balls. Luz presses them in a tortilla press and then tosses them onto the grill.
See how the corner's turning up right there? Then you know that you could turn it over the first time.
She hands one to Catriona.
I love the tortillas.
But why bother going through all this fuss when you can just buy them at the store? Three reasons. No additives, no pesticides, and...
they taste so sweet and mellow and like not chemical or metallic at all.
So I'm going to scoop a little bit of avocado onto each one, and then I'm going to squeeze some lime, because that really brings out the flavor of the corn, and then just a teeny sprinkle of salt.
And she makes me one.
They're so soft.
They just melt in your mouth. For Latino USA, I'm Tina Rubio, Oakland, California.
So what is your perfect tortilla? Let us know about your tortilla stories. Tweet us at LatinoUSA with the hashtag TortillaSnob. And now, a little more on the benefits of traditional Mexican food. UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, 2 years ago, included traditional Mexican cuisine on its list of world cultural treasures worth preserving. Now, a group of Mexican academics have put together the first cookbook to be included on UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage List. Latino USA's Brenda Salinas investigates further.
When you think of Mexican food, the first thing that comes to mind might be burritos or nachos, but that's not really Mexican. At least that's what the Mexican Gastronomic Conservatory told UNESCO.
We said, no, that is not Mexican. That comes from the south of the United States.
Margarita de Orellana helped publish the cookbook.
It's great, but it has nothing to do with the ways and the tradition of our cooking.
The conservatory organized experts and artists to create an authoritative guide to Mexican food. It focuses on the food of the Michoacán region, which UNESCO specifically highlighted. The book examines traditional kitchen utensils like the metate, a type of stone mortar and pestle, and indigenous ingredients like cacao, cocoa. There's also avocado, corn, and an Aztec delicacy called huitlacoche.
It's actually corn fungus, or, you know, the caviar of corn, like they call it.
That's Chef Joe Quintana at the restaurant where he cooks, Rosa Mexicano, in downtown New York City. Just looking at the book makes me hungry, so I ask him to make me some huitlacoche crepes.
Our crepes are just made up of flour, eggs, salt, and butter. You kind of want to make a little batter, like you're making pancakes. So what we're going to do is we're going to take one crepe, and we're going to put the huitlacoche mixture in it. We're going to roll it. We're going to put our sauce on top, which is a yellow pepper and mascarpone sauce. Once you put it on top, we're gonna sprinkle that on top, leave it in the broiler. There you have it. Huitlacoche con crepas.
I get to try it?
Yeah, it's fit to go.
So good.
But before I can finish, Chef Quintana takes the plate away. Apparently, this is only a tasting. Margarita de Orellana feels my pain.
That's one of the most exquisite dishes that we have because, you know, huitlacoche is a mushroom that's like a sickness of the corn and that grows all over the world, but nobody really knew what a specialty and how delicious and how wonderful this part of the corn is.
They really were delicious. I guess I'll just have to go back to Chef Quintana for a bigger helping. For Latino USA, I'm Brenda Salinas.
If you have a favorite traditional Mexican recipe that you think merits all kinds of attention, let us know on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. So, lots of us have Latino problems. Being bicultural, multicultural, ambicultural, it can lead to lots of misunderstandings. And many of us are left to navigate that cultural gap on our own. So, we want to help out. We've teamed up with Latina Magazine's Pauline Campos, who writes the magazine's Dímelo advice column. It was started by Dolores Prida, our dearly departed and muy querida amiga. But now Pauline Campos will be joining our show regularly to tackle your hashtag Latino problems. Our social media diva, Brenda Salinas and Pauline Campos, recently attended a conference in New York called Latism. It's a network of Latinos and Latinas in social media and technology. And they found plenty of people with plenty of questions.
The advice columnist is in. We spent the morning tweeting at conference goers to stop by during their lunch break. And it got busy really fast. In just half an hour, Pauline counseled a dozen Latinos on topics ranging from their activism to their relationships. Here are some of the day's best questions.
My name is Lisa. So my Latino problem is I do not speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
and often people think that makes me less Latina.
I get this question a lot, and the only thing you can do is to see yourself from the inside, because you're never going to be enough for everybody else. As long as you're enough for you, okay, you're golden. Okay. You are Latina, whether or not you speak Spanish. Yes. You are enough always. Okay. You're Latina if you feel you're Latina. Okay?
Okay.
That's you.
Okay.
That's all that matters.
We were at a social media conference, so we weren't surprised to get some questions about web etiquette.
My name is Annalie.
And what is your Latino problem?
My Latino problem is that when I upload a picture of myself, or say a selfie or something, my parents, they write obituary-like comments. Most of my friends will be like, oh, a nice pic or whatever, but my father would be like, may God have in your glory, such a pretty girl, such so talented, and
oh,
may the spirits always guide you the right way or something. And then my mom comes and comments afterward, things like, oh, my beautiful daughter, such a princess, I wish I could be with you right now, because we don't live in the same state, but she makes it seem like I'm gone in another dimension.
Okay, so we need to talk to mommy and papi about social media and how that works?
Yes.
Without offending them, because they're mommy and papi and they love you and you love them. Let your parents know. Look, I know you're being nice, and I know you're being sweet, and you want to let everybody know that, you know, you love me, mm-hmm, which is great, but maybe just, I love you, mija. We'll
That's
get it across.
It.
You know, just straight, and then give him a kiss and a hug and take him out to dinner.
Yeah, that would be nice if I could. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you hit it with love, laughter, and let them know that you love what they're doing, but
it's not that way.
It's not that way, then you should be okay on being able to connect with them without hurting their feelings.
Guys didn't really stop by. They would stop to check out the poster, point to my equipment, and then keep on walking. But Pablo stepped up to the plate.
My name is Pablo, and I think one of the problems that I have is sometimes, you know, the image of Latinos is, it's hard to break through. And, you know, one of the things that I've always thought is that, you know, I might speak with an accent, but I don't think with an accent. So what is the way for us to actually, you know, break through that barrier and actually communicate that?
Bottom line. You cannot change the rest of the world. What you can do is just keep on being who you are, being true to yourself, continuing to, I love what you said, think without an accent. That's brilliant. The people who are open-minded will eventually go, aha, I'm sorry about that. And then, you know, the racist idiots who are going to keep their minds closed are just going to keep their minds closed.
Sounds good.
We loved Pablo's mantra. We may speak with an accent, but we don't think with one. For Latino USA, I'm Brenda Salinas.
Pauline Campos will be back on Latino USA to answer your Latino problems. Tweet at us using the hashtag Latino Problems, and you could be on the air. And just a reminder, you don't have to be Latino to have a Latino problem. Issues of food and health can be very serious. But performance artist Robert Karimi thinks that it's important to approach these issues with humor and by telling stories, which is what he's done with the character he's developed called Mero Cocinero, and what he's doing with his new show called Viva la Soul Power. Robert Karimi brings us now these words of wisdom, a little sabiduría to chew on.
Right now, I'm thinking about someone who made me laugh, who just passed on to the spirit world, José Montoya, a powerful warrior, poeta, artista, puro Chicano, co-founder of the Royal Chicano Air Force, an elder wise advisor to so many of us. I will always remember him, though, for the first time he saw me cook. I was performing as Mero Cocinero, and I made soy chorizo breakfast tacos for a group of people at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley. Jose walked up to me super en serio, gave me a big hug, y me dijo, "You tell people that Jose Montoya of the Royal Chicano Air Force eats soy chorizo. They can tell me to eat better, but they can't take away my chorizo." I laughed, but he was serious. He said he had diabetes and changed his diet to control it. So I told people what he said, and it sometimes changed their mind. Jose does it? Wow. It got me talking with a lot of elders in my community and got me thinking about the power of the lengua. Many times the information our community gets about type 2 diabetes or obesity is from doctors. It could be really heavy-handed, not so delicioso, and sometimes crazy, wrong, fear-based. I mean, when we did some workshops in San Antonio, a Mexican-American mother told me that her doctor says her culture is the reason she has type 2 diabetes and would not get better unless she separated from her cultural recipes. The woman, crying, begged to know why her doctor would say such a thing. I had no answer, except I kept wondering, why is this doctor's chisme better than anybody else's chisme? That doctor, the way he dismissed that woman's culture, was so rootless and ill-said. My mom and other women and men from my neighborhood have been giving me recipes on how to heal myself for decades. They always work, too. The brandy in the tea, the huizquil in the chicken caldo, eating an onion with honey, turmeric for anti-inflammation, even recipes to make friends, keep your boss happy, or even your lover. And there's always a story behind them. Maybe there is a scientific study for it, but it doesn't matter. They are the authorities in my life. They care for me and my nourishment, and they see food as medicina, not something to fear. Medicina. Now, what I'm saying might upset the medical community, but it happens all the time. I mean, I just told all these people on Facebook I was sick, and I got all these suggestions for garlic ajo, ginger, caldo. No doctors, just this is how you do it. Words like healthy, nutritious can sometimes land like expletives, but an invitation to eat or saying, my mom does this, is as powerful and should be honored. Bottom line, the doctors, the people of the neighborhood, all have to think about how we share information. But always question. Talk to the source. Find out the stories that nourish. In the end, it's all an act of faith.
Robert Karimi as Mero Cocinero. His performance project, Viva La Soul Power, has online and live events in Chicago throughout the month of October. Check out our website for more information. And that's it for this week's show. ¿Todavía tienes hambre? Are you still hungry for more? Well, visit our website, latinousa.org. Our program was produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Diana Montaño, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. An extra thanks to Lisa Morehouse for her help with our food swamp story. We had additional engineering this week from Stephanie LeBeau and Brendan Baker. Our interns are Avery Truffleman and Jonathan Wolf. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week on air or by podcast. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And you can check out my own Instagram at Maria_La_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, and the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at aecf.org. This is NPR.